have ever seen. All the drama, all the big moments. The Paralympic Games, from Thursday on BBC Radio 5 Live and 5 Live Sports Extra.
This is Radio 3. It's 12 o'clock and time for Private Passions with Michael Barclay. Today there's another chance to hear an edition first broadcast in June 2010.
Cecil Belmond is an engineer extraordinaire. His praises have been sung by most of the world's leading architects, people like Philip Johnson, Rem Koolhaas and Daniel Liebeskind, and by artists like Anish Kapoor. Small wonder, Cecil, that you're now both a writer and an architect yourself. It's what you have enabled architects to do from an engineering point of view that has made you so invaluable to them and led you to realise your own constructions.
Yes, I mean, I think the engagement of structure, if you do it in a formulaic way, you just repeat the modules and the frames you see going up on the city skylines. But I realised some time ago that actually structure itself is episodic and it creates episodes in space. If you start to think of one thing relating to another thing, you start to enter the sequence of making something. And so if I had to pressy what I do in a way, the classical formulaic way of making a building work in both architecture and structural design would be spacing the gap. You put one thing and you space things apart. My work basically started to compile the interval, which is a reversal process. One thing relates to another in a very fixed way, as against spacing the gap. It's a small thing to say, but it's very important between spacing the gap and compiling the interval.
You're a musician then.
Well,
It's a very musical analogy.
Well, it is. I mean, and I think that's why there's all sorts of references to architecture being frozen music. But yes, my theories of the informal, which I theorized and postulated in a book long ago, was probably now in hindsight, it's obviously drawing from musical analogies, because I talk of three categories of design: a locality, the local effect, juxtapositions, and hybridization. For me, translating that into music, the locality is the melody line, the melodic piece of note, as it were. The juxtaposition is rhythm, it's the rhythm of the piece, and hybrid is the chordal harmonics behind the piece. So in a way, the architecture resembles that too. There's the columns and the beams and the elements that are localities. Then how they relate to each other spatially is rhythmic, is juxtaposition. And the entire ensemble of one room to another is a kind of hybridization of the whole piece then being the piece of architecture.
You were born in Sri Lanka, weren't you? And you, your parents both love music.
That's right. I was born in Sri Lanka and my mother was a classical piano teacher. So I grew up with music in the house. I was a terror of a child, I'm told, disrupting all the musical lessons she used to conduct. But and my father was amateur pianist. He played in the Charlie Kunz style, very relaxed left hand on the piano. But he also played bass. And so I was surrounded by music and grew up with music. And my mother was also a great pianist, separate to playing classical music. And they used to both entertain. So I remember those days being quite embarrassed, actually. I was about 12 or 13. And at the end of a night's function, when the band stops at 2 a.m, my mother would get up then and play. And then when she gave up, my father would go and play. And I was to be sort of cringing with embarrassment. My parents were showing off on the stage. But it must have just sort of seeped through into me, because I absolutely adore music. And listen to it every day, most of the day, when I can.
Does your first piece go back to those childhood days?
Yes, I've picked Chopin because she played Chopin a lot. I can't remember the Beethoven sonatas and things, but obviously I do remember some of them. But it was mainly she loved Chopin, and I sort of grew up loving the whole repertoire of Chopin.
Thank you.
So much passion and drama and yet grace. You know, it's a hallmark of Chopin. He somehow managed to do this. It's like always when I listen to a Chopin piece, it's this sort of feeling of a jewel sparkling and also being cut and very refined. Because I know Chopin admired a lot of the work of Bach and worked hard at these compositions. Apparently, you know, reading about his life, he used to knock it off very quickly on the piano, but then spend ages making it really work as a piece. And of course, we don't know the effort that went into it, but you feel it. It always feels just quite appropriate, even with all the flourishes and the cascades and the notes. It just always feels appropriate and interesting, you know.
I suspect there was an element of improvisation as the starting point for Chopin because he was such a good pianist.
One feels that, yeah, yeah, I agree.
It seems to lie under the hands.
I think that's probably why I enjoy the music. Well, it feels improvisatory in a way, you know, it doesn't feel very formally laid out, but yet I'm sure it's all worked out.
And especially as played with quite a bit of rubato there.
Yeah, well, I was, yeah, Rubinstein, I was really slowing down there with a lot of rubato, yeah.
We heard the Fantasy Impromptu No. 4 in C sharp minor, Opus 66 by Chopin, played by Arthur Rubinstein. Now, you mentioned Bach there, Cecil Balmont, and I would have thought to somebody of your calling, he must be a kind of god, really, because he manages to do so many of the things that you've been talking about.
Yes, I mean, for me, Bach is a miracle worker. I listen to Bach, probably the most listened to composer in my work. I listen to Bach all the time. He was a supreme master of form, and how he did it is incredible.
And of course, with the music we're going to hear, he does it with a single line, essentially.
I think it's because the harmony is stretched out. It's always making its harmony as it travels along the line.
It's implying it.
It's often implying it. And I never really got Bach properly, I would say, till I started to play Bach myself. And that, for me, was the big revelation. Actually, under my own finger, I play classical guitar. Not very well, but, you know, I learned to play and enjoyed the feeling of how this chromatic sense of movement, how just a note would move and everything would shift in your perspective as you're playing, the feelings you get in the music. And this constant revelation about to happen as the line keeps moving. And the ultimate for me in that with Bach was the Chaconne in D minor. It's transposed for guitar by Segovia.
Well, you mentioned Segovia, and it is actually another great Spanish musician that we're going to hear playing the cello, Pablo Casals. And this is from the G major suite.
Yes.
And again, there's a sort of dance-like feel to the music, isn't there?
Yeah, and again, the saraband, which we start with, it's profound. You know, these sort of slow movements that Bach managed as well to conjure deep melody, melodic content out of this traveling harmony, as I said. Thank you.
Pablo Casals played the Saraband and the Minuets 1 and 2 from the Cello Suite No. 1 in G major by Bach, BWV 1007. Several architects have remarked, Cecil Belmont, that you are able to bring a kind of mysticism to engineering, which I thought was rather interesting given that we've just been listening to Bach, where he seems to bring a mysticism to a single line. Let's take something like Anish Kapoor and the sculpture you did helped him with. You know, are you helping him realize in construction that which he has in his mind as a drawing, say?
No, what really happens is in the work I do, it's a collaboration. Anish Kapoor and I have worked on four projects now. We started with the Tate Gallery in 2002.
The famous one in
The
in
red
the turbine.
The red piece made out of a fabric. Mm-hmm. We talk about the forms, and we had different forms at the time. Then together, we work out what is appropriate and what can the material really do, and that's why we collaborate. Mm-hmm. He's working in forms in a certain abstract way, so am I. And then the realization is a joint production, really. And so it's never someone saying, here's a piece of work and now make that work, which is a sort of, I think, a popular image of about what engineers may be doing.
Yes, and rather a frustrating one for you, since you actually can, and they do acknowledge, I mean, that you contribute a great deal
more than that. It's a collaboration. My collaborations with the architect Rem Koolhaas, and Toyo Ito, the Japanese architect, we work together closely. They are collaborations. And we learn from each other. I am influenced by Kapoor, and I'm hoping he's influenced by me. And so that in the end, what we're working on, we're doing four projects up north in Teesside.
They look very beautiful.
Yeah, very graceful projects. Yes. And then there's the London Olympics, hopefully the sculpture for 2012.
Which we've seen...
We've just released it. We're now going for planning.
Yeah.
And that's a full three-dimensional piece. It's very hard to see in a two-dimensional picture in the papers. Mm. It's a very exciting three-dimensional sense of space that we're trying to make there. And in that sort of size, 120 meters high, you know, it's beyond the confines of a studio or a simple model. We both have to work together on that.
I think you must have, presumably, sooner or later, some guitar music, since that's your great baby, as it were.
Yeah, well, I started, you know, what can you do when your mother's a good pianist and your father's a good pianist? I took music piano lessons and I got up to grade 7 or 6, I can't remember now, but I not a good idea when your mother teaches you, you know. So I rebelled in a way, didn't do it, and I picked up a guitar. And I picked this Paganini as the first piece in that for the guitar. I mean, I would love to have picked many a piece again. But this one was the first serious piece of music I felt as a difficult, technically as well, to play. And I chose this. And also because John Williams is the guitarist on this program. I love Julian Bream as well and a lot of other...
I often think they're all like Mozart and Beethoven, that John Williams has all the facility and Bream has a sort of Beethovenian inner...
Bream playing jazz in his spare time early on as a young man helps phrase certain things. His Bach playing is beautiful.
Well, he adored Django.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, I think that gives his playing a certain width. Well, Williams is, I picked this because, A, it was the first time I was into music at my university in Southampton and organized concerts as well, and I ran the club, music club there. And I invited Williams down, and we didn't know who he was really at the time. He was making, he's just had his debut in London. And a couple of years later, I remember this mini Morris Minor sort of coming, and this guy getting our young fellow with a guitar, this battered case. And he just felt like one of us, you know. And then he came into the room and started warming up. And I'd just begun playing classical guitar in a way. I did the Villa Lobos preludes and I was doing those sort of standard saw minuets and all those studies. And then suddenly there was this virtuoso playing going on. And the kind of facility he had was tremendous. So I was completely knocked out. And at the concert, I remember him playing the Mozart variations and... Mm-hmm. I just sat there thinking, God, one pair of fingers did all that. And so I went in, and so this piece in particular
Paganini.
Was the first major, the Paganini piece, was the first piece I learned as a more serious, lengthy piece. All three movements are gorgeous. I've picked just the first movement here. What I like about that playing is the attack on the strings. I have actually other recordings, but this was Williams at his young. He was probably 21 when this record was made, just after he'd debuted in New York and London. And it's just that fierce attack, you know, it's a young man's attack on the piece, which I love.
As you say, it's a musicality in terms of timing, but also a kind of utter confidence.
And sheer, I think that's right, the sheer confidence, which allows the music to just breathe. And I think the fact that the timing can be slightly fractionally early even in the attack, it doesn't matter. I mean, it's not that strict rhythm of the Bach playing that now we've got used to, where people don't like any variation on the timing. I find still a kind of pleasure in, and same with Segovia, same generation, playing guitar. His attack on the strings, on the fast pieces, fabulous.
Glenn Gould had that as well.
And Glenn Gould, I mean, the well-tempered clavier. I listen to Gould. In fact, all the Bach piano music is Gould that I listen to.
Music from the first movement of the Grand Sonata in A Major by Paganini, played and transcribed, by the way, by the guitarist John Williams. Cecil, you've written books which have actually been very influential, and anyone who's trying to understand some of these things that we've been talking about, you know, the way a line can float and that kind of thing. Actually, the books are quite good because you've got little drawings, like in Informal, which was published in 2002. And so you begin to see these things on the page and how they fit into buildings.
Yes, because I think I have pursued a certain animation to geometry. And that was inspired directly by going back to reading and studying the Greeks and how they started. I mean, architecture began, in a way, with Greece.
I've often thought you ought to like more contemporary music because Yanis Xenakis, well, you know, is a great engineer as well as
I mean, I was, in fact, there's a Xenakis, there's a great exhibition of Xenakis' work in New York at the moment.
You've not chosen sort of modern or avant-garde music at all, but are you interested in it?
Not a lot. I mean, I listen to some of the electronic music.
On the other hand, you love jazz. And, of course, there's quite a direct link to Bach with jazz, I always feel.
Well, I think everything links back to Bach in
But the improvisatory nature and the fact that he'll often use, you know, a sort of ground bass, rather like jazz players will take a basic chord structure or a bass line and
yeah, build on. I mean, like the, you know, the Chaconne is only four sort of big harmonic pivots.
And
it's
the whole, like a blues.
The whole piece unfolds, exactly. Yeah. The blues has a structure. I listen to a lot of jazz, and maybe that's where my modernity comes in, maybe. I've taken that branch of music, particularly from early swing music, but I mainly listen to John Coltrane and the whole bebop movement that began after Dizzy Gillespie and Charlie Parker.
You've got a great collection of players here, Lionel Hampton, Gene Krupa, Teddy Wilson, Benny Goodman.
Yeah, I cannot think of four more talented players who came together ever. And the fact that each of them, Lionel Hampton, a vibraphone player, Krupa, a great drummer, Teddy Wilson, a fabulous pianist, and Benny Goodman, you know, a great clarinetist. But somehow the four of them, when you hear them playing together, they are not just following a leader. They're not following Benny Goodman. You know, they are all independently making music. And I think the Benny Goodman Quartet, which I picked a piece from, I remember the first 10 LPs bought into my home when I was a boy, about 8 or 9, were 10. And there was a Beethoven a concerto and a symphony, number 3. Prokofiev, of all things, and there was something else, and there was the Benny Goodman Quartet playing. And from that, I got introduced to jazz and listened to a lot of jazz, and of course now more advanced jazz.
And this is Runnin' Wild. Wonderful. They're enjoying themselves so much.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, my goodness. I mean, Running Wild, what a title as well. It just can't help, you know, tapping your foot to that. And they were all absolutely having a ball, and I'm sure of it. They enjoyed playing together.
Benny Goodman with Teddy Wilson, Gene Krupa and Lionel Hampton, and Runnin' Wild. Of course, Benny Goodman was responsible for helping that sort of crossover of music, you know, classical and jazz. And it's interesting to think how the clarinet, in a way, came into being fairly late, after all, just during Mozart's life mm-hmm. with Anton Stadler. But by the time it had got to Brahms, of course, he really made the most of it, didn't mm-hmm. he?
I wanted the Brahms clarinet quintet to follow this because I find, not that they're directly comparable, but the sonority of the clarinet, something I've always been interested in, from, of course, Mozart's Clarinet Concerto to Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue, the soaring clarinet line, amazing line. And friends of mine used to play oboe, so I've always liked the wind instrument side against the... though I grew up with the percussive idea of the piano and things. And the clarinet quintet of Brahms is... I picked next because I think there's... It's a wonderful piece of music in its own right, but it also draws on this late Brahms, because early Brahms is a bit difficult in a way, and he was so much under the shadow of Beethoven's great symphonic work. And I think if you listen to early Brahms, there's always, I feel, some kind of references going on. But this late work is towards the end of his career. He wrote the clarinet quintet, and it's seamlessly effortless and mature piece of work.
And also the clarinet seems to be, in the mellifluous sense, such a Brahmsian creature.
Yes. I mean, it's the sonority of the piece, and it's as sensuous a piece of music as you can get, in a way. Pre-impressionist music, you know, it's just there. The whole piece seems wonderful to me. We had to fade there because it goes on, but that music just opens inevitably like a flower and
blossoming,
it just blossoms along. It's wonderful. It's sort of spirit of, for me, it has all the sort of spirit of Schumann in it almost, you know, and yet that form that Brahms was always following, very tightly organized, beautifully written piece.
So he did get something from Beethoven.
He did. I think he did there, yes.
The opening of the first movement of the clarinet quintet in B minor, opus 115 by Brahms. The clarinetist was Carl Leister with the Amadeus Quartet. I was interested, since we were talking about Beethoven, actually, Cecil Belmont, that you wanted to get away from some of the sort of heavy statements, the structures, to something that was lighter.
Yes, well, the Beethoven is Adelaide from the Seven Lieder. And the reason I picked this was that I love Beethoven, and I love listening to all the symphonies and the sonatas and a lot of piano music, all Brendel's playing. And I grew up really understanding Beethoven as this amazing maker of form and vision and true inspiration, in a way, every time I listen to Beethoven properly, really listen. And then very lately, a few years ago, I came across the song cycles. I never really knew, I never associated Beethoven with song. I thought Schubert. And for me, it's sort of the personal side of Beethoven in a way. And I found that he wrote songs all his life, about 70 or 80 songs, and even opus 128, right towards the end of his life, before the late quartets, he wrote a song, a very silly little song about a kiss.
And lots of folk song arrangements.
And folk songs, yeah. And I think, for me, there's a very warming, sort of a personal side of sort of Beethoven's heart being revealed in a way, as against the great cerebral worker of form in these songs. And Adelaide is, I think, one of his good songs. And he's walking around as a young man in a orchard, seeing the name Adelaide in the clouds, in the flowers, and wishes that from the ash of his grave will spring a flower that says Adelaide. Zarte Laube flüstern.
Adelaide from Seven Lieder, Opus 46 by Beethoven. The gorgeous artistry of Dietrich Fischer-Dieskau there, with Jürg Demus playing the piano. Cecil Belmont, you spent quite a lot of time in Africa, didn't you?
Yes, I was there for 3 years, on and off, and then lived there for three more years.
In Nigeria.
And it was a wonderful time of my life. It was just after university. And I was heavily involved with music there.
Choirs in particular.
Yes, I also played with the local high life bands and did gigs with them. I also trained youth choirs there and for television shows as well. And they have a natural ability to just sing. And I mean, I remember going to church in Nigeria. I don't often go to church regularly, but there it was a complete delight to go because the singing was amazing. Just the congregation singing in these sort of harmonies that they get up to. And it's not simple thirds or something, you know, it's quite complex. They just sing beautifully. And I found a complete delight working with these youth choirs for festivals and just singing on television or in public.
And this choir actually sort of epitomizes, doesn't it?
Well, this, yeah. I mean, Ladysmith Black Mambazo, which is a great grand name for this choir. I wish I could have heard them, you know, trained these people, but they're amazing. And I heard them sing Zulu hymns long, long ago, 20 years ago. And I was stunned by the musicianship and the tight harmony and the polyphonic rhythms almost. And the ability to just change rhythm as well when they want to. And it's rich. The vocal strain in Africa is extremely rich. And I just love the way they sing anyway. But here we have a choir that's also trained and, you know, really great performance. Everything they do, I love. It's mad, isn't it?
It's wonderful
the way they sing and put these recitative bits in, yeah. And they can laugh in the middle of it. It's just this wonderful confidence again.
But I was going to say to you, they've got the same attack as Pablo Casals or John Williams.
Yeah.
Or,
I mean, as a singer, what did you think of that?
Oh, fantastic.
Lovely, isn't it?
Yes.
It's wonderful.
Una Matemba from Ladysmith Black Mambazo. Well, Cecil Belmont, we look forward to seeing in 3D your structure rising over the Olympic Village. In the next 2 or 3 years. Meanwhile, can I thank you very much for introducing us to the music that often accompanies your work.
Thank you. Thank you, Michael.
Cecil Balmond was talking to Michael Barclay. That edition of Private Passions was first broadcast 2 years ago in June 2010. And next Sunday, there's another chance to hear the artist Tacita Dean sharing her musical passions with Michael. That's next Sunday at the same time, midday. Private Passions is a classic arts production for BBC Radio 3. The producer of today's edition was Chris Marshall.
On Radio 3, Bank Holiday Monday at the BBC Proms. At 1 o'clock, Christina Schaefer performs Schoenberg's Piero Lunaire.
Piero, here to the rest, here.
At 3, a journey to the far corners of our musical world with the gospel vocal group Blind Boys of Alabama.
Amazing grace.
And at 8 o'clock, Proms favourite John Wilson recreates the Broadway sound with the help of his hand-picked high-octane orchestra. A packed Bank Holiday Monday at the BBC Proms. Hear it all live on BBC Radio 3 from 1 o'clock.
As for tonight's prom, it opens with Wagner's Parsifal, the Act 3 prelude, and the luminous Good Friday music. Daniele Gatti conducts the Gustav Mahler Youth Orchestra, and violinist Frank Peter Zimmermann joins them for the Berg Violin Concerto. That's after the Wagner. And that's all live from the Royal Albert Hall at 7:30 tonight. This is BBC Radio 3. We're broadcasting on 90 to 93 FM on digital radio. You can also listen to us live online in high-definition sound. 1 o'clock just gone. The news now read by Lopa Katari.
Opposition activists have accused the Syrian government of a massacre after scores of bodies were found in the town of Daraa on the outskirts of Damascus. They've released a video showing what appears to be bodies of young men lined up. The pictures have not been independently verified. Syrian state television said the town was being purified of what it described as terrorist remnants. The Foreign Office says it's deeply concerned by the reports. The Culture Secretary, Jeremy Hunt, has said he could not see the public interest in publishing photographs of Prince Harry naked in a hotel room in Las Vegas. The Sun newspaper said it was exercising its freedom to print a photograph that was already widely available on the internet. Mr. Hunt acknowledged that it was up to editors what they printed. Catholic priests in Scotland have been reading out a letter in their churches criticising the Scottish government for its intention to introduce gay marriage. The initiative comes a week after the leader of the church in Scotland, Cardinal Keith O'Brien, broke off personal talks about the issue with the First Minister, Alex Salmond. The letter has been criticised by gay rights groups. A British man imprisoned in the Central African Republic after being accused of mass murder has been cleared of all the charges he was facing. David Simpson, a 24-year-old safari pilot, was detained after reporting the discovery of 13 mutilated bodies 5 months ago. He was released from custody last week on medical grounds after suffering from malaria. President Obama has led the many tributes to Neil Armstrong, the first man to set foot on the moon, who's died at the age of 82. Mr. Obama described him as one of the greatest American heroes, not just of his own time, but of all time. The Duke of Edinburgh has made his first public appearance since being discharged from hospital in Aberdeen on Monday. He accompanied the Queen to church near Balmoral. And finally, the weather. It'll be a cloudy but dry afternoon and evening. Most parts will see some sunshine. Temperatures will range from 20 degrees Celsius in the southeast to the mid-teens in Scotland. And that's the latest BBC News. The time is just gone 2 minutes past one.
And it was read by Lopa Katari. Time now on Radio 3 for the Early Music Show, which today pays homage to a Queen of France. It's presented by Catherine Bott.
In this little vessel of fine gold, pure and clean, rests a heart greater than any lady in the world ever had. Anne was her name, twice Queen in France, Duchess of the Bretons, royal and sovereign.
Thank you.
Cruel fate, you have caused us great distress by spitefully summoning before your court our mistress and sovereign lady. Fier à Tropos by Pierre Moulu, performed by Douce Mémoire, directed by Denis Razin d'Adre. And before that music, I read the words carved on the reliquary that contained the heart of Anne of Brittany. Twice Queen of France, the richest woman in Europe, and a lady who seems to have been universally admired, respected and loved. Her funeral was an epic affair, lasting 40 days, becoming the model for all French royal funerals for 200 years. It's so well documented that we can play quite a lot of the music from it in today's early music show. Her actual life story was dominated by one thing, marriage to the right man. And she was married three times. So, are you sitting comfortably? Then I'll begin. I need to rattle through the tale in less time than it takes to get hitched in a Las Vegas wedding chapel. Anne was born in 1477 in Nantes, the daughter of François, second Duke of Brittany. The Duchy of Brittany was a feudal state in northwestern France, subject to the ancient Salic law, which meant that a woman could only inherit if there were no eligible men living. By the time little Anne was born, her father was the only male survivor of his ducal line, and sadly, she was to be the only one of his children to live to adulthood. Duke François had her officially recognised as his heir, and soon began to seek a suitable husband for her. He was determined to preserve Breton independence, so Anne needed to marry a man capable of withstanding the power of the Kingdom of France. She wasn't short of suitors. At the age of six, she was promised in marriage to the 13-year-old Edward, Prince of Wales, but his mysterious disappearance as one of the princes in the Tower in 1483 brought that dynastic betrothal to a sudden end. Next, Duke François was forced to sign a treaty which stipulated that any daughter of his was not to marry without the approval of the French king. And then Anne's father fell off his horse and died, leaving her Sovereign Duchess of Brittany, Countess of Nantes, Montfort and Richemont, and Viscountess of Limoges. Her suitors in the late 1480s included the Prince of Orange, the Duke of Orléans, who was already married, and Maximilian I of Austria. It was decided that he was the most suitable candidate for her hand.